we have come in a series in the book of Revelation to some of the letters to the seven churches. And there was a very important large church in the city called Pergamum or Pergamos. And if you will study that in some of the Bible dictionaries, you will find that it for a long time was looked upon as the capital of Asia, even a more important city than Ephesus. And there was were great temples in the city of Pergamos. And these great temples there were built to some of the so-called gods, the deities of the day, such as Zeus Soter. There was Athena, a major temple to Asclepius, who was one of the so-called healing gods of that day. The coins claimed that Pergamos was a huge city with three temples to the emperor with their separate attendants and priests and their rituals and services. Have you ever gone to Europe or to South America, maybe even to Mexico City? If you've ever gone to some of the great basilicas, especially in some of the Catholic countries, you have seen sites there that are so totally unlike anything that we know of in the United States. They're just completely different. That even sometimes the same religion can be so totally different from country to country. I was quite struck when I first visited Mexico City way back in the 1950s. I've visited there many, many times since. When I had the occasion to go out to the Basilica de the Virgin of Guadalupe, the Virgen de Guadalupe, as they call her down there, and she is the patron saint of all of the Latin-speaking races. She is supposed to have been a virgin who appeared in a great vision of the sun with the moon under her feet, almost like the picture of the church in Revelation, the 12th chapter. And here outside, that huge basilica lining the streets in all directions, were shops and bazaars of every colorful description you could imagine. And in those shops and bazaars were all sorts of artifacts. I mean, from chalk and plaster to wood, onyx, or marble, even silver and gold, statuary, tapestries, home altars, boxes, coins, slogans, chains, rings, and other jewelry of every kind, scarves for the ladies to put over their heads if they didn't have something to wear on their heads to go inside this basilica. And here were the long lines of people who came down this central avenue in which, in the middle, there were quarried stones. And depending upon the desire, depending upon the degree, I suppose, of their trouble, whether it was a very grievously ill person in the family or a child or a deformity or an aging grandparent about to die, depending upon the degree of their distress, I suppose it lengthened their journey. But these poor folk would quite literally, in some cases of extreme agony over a desired favor from the Virgin, crawl on their knees on this quarried rough stone 5 miles up into this basilica, and up to the golden altar, all the time muttering prayers, saying the rosary, crossing themselves, and beseeching the Virgin of Guadalupe for help. Now that's dedication. I may not believe that they are correct, but I certainly must stand in virtual awe of the unbelievable dedication of some of these people. But lining the streets all around that giant basilica were the artifacts of the tradesmen. And you began to get the feeling that there's a giant commercialization going on here of thousands of dollars being sold to pilgrims who would come from all over, and maybe they would take one of these little statues or a little niche to go put in the corner of their home somewhere, and almost like a little tiny temple inside their home. Well, now, in this letter to the church at Pergamos, the place to which we had come last time in this series, we're going to see that there were great temples in the city of Pergamos that were just a lot like some of these major basilicas of today, and that the commercial life of the great city, as well as its religious and political life, tended to swirl around these major temples and all sorts of other buildings that were there. It says, beginning in verse 12 of the second chapter of Revelation, "Unto the angel of the church in Pergamos," or Pergamum, as it says in most of the ancient writings, "write this: These things says he that has the sharp sword with two edges." Now the Bible talks about the sword of the Word of God, a two-edged sword that cuts asunder even to the very marrow of the bone, that discerns the innermost thoughts of the human heart. And that certainly is what is implied here. He says, "I know thy works, and where you dwell, even where Satan's seat is." The most ancient records show that there was a major temple there to this one so-called healing god of Asclepius, and that people would actually go and sleep in some of the smaller rooms of that temple, and then during the night would expect to have dreams revealed to them, showing them what form of healing this god would grant them. Maybe it had to do with going out and burning a bunch of smelly old rags to get rid of a demon or something. But whatever it was that they came up with, there was a tremendous belief in these gods. You can almost hear the conversation of people around the public squares and bazaars of the city of Pergamum. Well, what did Zeus do for you today? Oh, not too much, but Diana sure did me a big favor. And they'd talk about their gods. They believed that their gods had human appetites, that they cohabited with human beings. They had wars. They went galloping across the sun, the moon, and the stars, half-clad. Sometimes they looked like half-goats and half-men, half-men and half-horses. They had orgies. And a lot of the temple services, a lot of the religious life of some of these ancient cities in which these early New Testament Christian colonies sprang up, largely among some of the Jewish colonies that were there, because the early New Testament church in its first century was largely Jewish, with the exception of those who in this area of Asia and of Iconium, Lystra, Derbe, and some of the Grecian cities where there were colonies of Jews to which Paul went first, yet nevertheless, a little later on, the church under Paul's administration finally became largely Gentile. But they were Jewish to begin with. And there were colonies of Jews in these cities who were existing side by side with some of the pagan religions as well as the pagan businesses of the cities. And you can prove in later works concerning Pergamus that there was a definite harmonization of life between a Jewish priest who was there and apparently a fairly important synagogue and, on the other hand, some of these large pagan temples dedicated to various pagan deities. So there were flourishing artworks in engraving, quarrying, casting, molding. And that meant that thousands of people were engaged in the manufacture, the distribution, and the sale of religious artifacts. Because it is one huge temple, as well as many other temples, it is said in this letter to the church of Pergamus that you dwell where Satan's seat is. And you hold fast my name, he said in verse 13 of chapter 2, and have not denied my faith, even in those days wherein Antipas, my faithful martyr, was slain among you where Satan dwells. Now, history does not record any other mention of this Antipas. There is no way to go back and find out exactly who he was. You must rely entirely on Revelation 2:13 for any mention of him. But then you have to realize that history is largely searching through the garbage dumps and the piles of refuse of the destruction of war, such as the very fact that a large library in the city of Pergamus was burnt in earlier years under some of the wars between the Ptolemies and the Seleucidae, and that even the great Alexandria library of more than 200,000 clay tablets was destroyed. And oftentimes when one conqueror comes in and takes over another nation, the first thing he wants to do is to destroy the literature and the culture, the intelligentsia of that nation, to virtually wipe out its very underpinnings of its society and its civilization. So unfortunately, historians, especially archaeologists, are reduced to, as it were, searching through the rubble of the past. The things that people threw out that they didn't want anymore, that which was trampled underfoot, that which became landfill. Many an excavation project, including those in Jerusalem and other areas, are merely going through the rubble that was simply swept aside and piled up in a heap, and it formed the foundation for yet new buildings of successive generations. So sometimes history is just not that accurate, and history is largely interpretive anyway. But there is no other historical mention of the man named Antipas that you can find in history than Revelation, the second chapter, and the 13th verse. But he goes on to say, "But I have a few things against you, because you have there them that hold the doctrine of Balaam, who taught Balak to cast a stumbling block before the children of Israel, to eat things sacrificed unto idols, and to commit fornication." It was quite common that living in a city such as this, with practically a temple on every corner, with all different ranks of priesthood, with all sorts of temple prostitutes and harlots who were actually performing sex acts as a part of temple rituals and orgies, that some of the people of the early New Testament Christian church who would be converted in listening to the preaching of Paul, Apollos, and so many other of the preachers and teachers who came through, would finally, in the days, weeks, and months that would follow, in listening to other teachers, some of whom would urge them to go right ahead into some of these rites, and of course they had lived that way, that was their way of life, that was their style of life, for all of their lives in the past, it seemed natural. They believed that their gods had orgies, they believed they should have orgies. And finally, when that type of insidious heresy would find its way right inside the church, as it did in this church at Pergamus, here then is a sharp rebuke from, as it says, him that stood in the midst of the seven golden candlesticks and who carried the seven stars, meaning the angels of the churches, in his right hand, that there were those inside that church of God in the New Testament who were actually teaching some of the members of the church to eat meats sacrificed unto idols, and to commit fornication. Now, there is a factor, bear in mind here, that it was virtually impossible to eat any meat that wasn't sacrificed to an idol, because for a long time in some of those cities of Asia and elsewhere in the Peloponnesus of Greece and even up to Rome, the word to kill in their language and to sacrifice was one and the same thing. It was just like some of the changing of etymological derivations of words in the United States or in our English language. We have many different words that have totally changed meaning over a period of years. When a person says, "Oh, I was just mortified the other day," they weren't really. It meant they were humiliated. Mortified means to be completely stiffened and killed. It means slain. It means dead. But we sometimes water down the meanings of words, and we deal in hyper-superlatives. Like we say, "I'm freezing to death," when we're just a little chilly. Or we say, "I'm about to starve, let's go eat," or what have you. Well, back then, the word to sacrifice and to kill was one and the same thing, because all animals virtually in those Gentile cities were sacrificed, and then the meat first divided up to the priests and taken out and sold in the shambles, as the meat markets were called. And the meat sellers received only meat that basically was slaughtered underneath the temple or in the area of the temple beneath some grinning idol of some sort. And of course, there were various schools of thought in the New Testament. The Apostle Paul later on showed some of the Gentile converts that they didn't need to worry about that, that the fact that the meat was slain in front of an idol's temple didn't taint the meat, that you could eat it if you wanted to, but if someone else, he explained, to the Roman church, were upset by it, if their conscience were defiled, then you shouldn't eat meat in front of them or let them know about it. He said, "While the world stands, lest I should offend my brother." So he gave them, in a sense, permission to go ahead and do it, because he said the idol is nothing. It doesn't taint the meat. The idol is non-existent. It's just a piece of rock or wood or what have you, and is non-existent. And why would that bother the meat one way or the other? Which is easy to understand today in a Christian society, of course. But here there were those who were actually teaching them that they needed to do that to get right back into some of the pagan rites and rituals from which they had come out. And he said in verse 15, "So you have also them that hold the doctrine of the Nicolaitanes." Now this was a sect of people, a follower of Nicholas, and very likely there may be some overlap there in the meaning of that name between Saint Nick that finds its way into the Christmas observations of today, believe it or not. And there is some speculation about whether or not Simon the Magus, that is the magician, that you read of in the 8th chapter of the book of Acts, a great sorcerer whom the Apostle Paul and others came in contact with, might not have been behind this religious sect. That was a sect that dealt in almost total licentiousness. It was almost as if the more they sinned, the greater was the mercy of God, because it showed God's greatness to be able to forgive them their sins. But he said there were those who had the doctrine of the Nicolaitanes, which thing, he said, I hate. And he said they needed to repent, verse 16, "or else I will come unto you quickly and will fight against them with the sword of my mouth."